Archipelago, Volume 1, Section 1, continued.
Cassette 7, Side 1.
No one could deny him one point of superiority. He was much stronger and more visceral than those others had been. His shoulders and hands retained their strength, even though they had not needed it for a long time. Freed from the restraints of courtesy, he stared sternly and spoke impersonally, as if he didn't even consider the possibility of a dissenting view. He had grown up differently from those others, too, and he worked differently. His father had ploughed the earth in the most literal sense. Lenya, Z-blank-V, had been one of those disheveled, unenlightened peasant boys whose wasted talents so distressed Belinsky and Tolstoy. He was certainly no Lomonosov, and he could never have gotten to the academy on his own, but he was talented. If there had been no revolution, he would have ploughed the land, and he would have become well-to-do because he was energetic and active, and he might have raised himself into the merchant class. It being the Soviet period, however, he entered the Komsomol, and his work in the Komsomol, overshadowing his other talents, lifted him out of anonymity, out of his lowly state, out of the countryside, and shot him like a rocket through the workers' school, right into the Industrial Academy. He arrived there in 1929, at the very moment when those other engineers were being driven in whole herds into Gulag. It was urgently necessary for those in power to produce their own engineers, politically conscious, loyal, 100%ers, who were to become bigwigs of production, Soviet businessmen, in fact, rather than people who did things themselves. That was the moment when the famous commanding heights overlooking the as-yet uncreated industries were empty. And it was the fate of Z-blank-V's class in the Industrial Academy to occupy them. Z-blank-V's life became a chain of triumphs, a garland winding right up to the peak. Those were the exhausting years from 1929 to 1933, when the Civil War was being waged, not as in 1918 to 1920, with tachankas, machine guns mounted on horse-drawn carts, but with police dogs, when the long lines of those dying of famine trudged toward the railroad stations in the hope of getting to the cities, which is where the bread grains were evidently ripening, but were refused tickets and were unable to leave and lay dying beneath the station fences in a submissive human heap of homespun coats and bark shoes. In those same years, Z-blank-V not only did not know that bread was rationed to city dwellers, but at a time when a manual laborer was receiving 60 rubles a month in wages, he enjoyed a student's scholarship of 900 rubles a month. Z-blank-V's heart did not ache for the countryside whose dust he had shaken from his feet. His new life was already soaring elsewhere among the victors and the leaders. He never had time to be an ordinary run-of-the-mill foreman. He was immediately assigned to a position in which he had dozens of engineers and thousands of workers under him. He was the chief engineer of the big construction projects outside Moscow. From the very beginning of the war, he, of course, had an exemption from military service. He was evacuated to Alma-Ata, together with the department he worked for, and in this area he bossed even bigger construction projects on the Ili River. But in this case, his workers were prisoners. The sight of those little grey people bothered him very little at the time, nor did it inspire him to any reappraisals, nor compel him to take a closer look. In that gleaming orbit in which he circled, the only important thing was to achieve the projected totals, fulfilment of the plan. And it was quite enough for Z-blank-V merely to punish a particular construction unit, a particular camp, and a particular work superintendent. After that, it was up to them to manage to fulfill their norm with their own resources. How many hours they had to work to do it, or what ration they had to get along on, were details that didn't concern him. The war years, deep in the rear, were the best years in Z-blank-V's life. Such is the eternal and universal aspect of war. The more grief it accumulates at one of its poles, the more joy it generates at the other. Z-blank-V had not only a bulldog's jaw, but also a swift, enterprising, business-like grasp. With the greatest skill, he immediately switched to the economy's new wartime rhythm. Everything for victory. Give and take, and the war will write it all off. He made just one small concession to the war. He got along without suits and neckties, and camouflaging himself in khaki colour, had chrome leather boots made to order, and donned a general's tunic, the very one in which he appeared before us. That was fashionable and not uncommon at the time. It provoked neither anger in the war wounded, nor reproachful glances from women. Women usually looked at him with another sort of glance. They came to him to get well fed, to get warmed up, to have some fun. He had wild money passing through his hands. His billfold bulged like a little barrel with expense money, and to him 10-ruble notes were like kopecks, and thousands like single rubles. Z-blank-V didn't hoard them, regret spending them, or keep count of them. He counted only the women who passed through his hands, and particularly those he had uncorked. This count was his sport. In the cell he assured us that his arrest had broken off the count at 290+, and he regretted that he had not reached 300. Since it was wartime and the women were alone and lonely, and since in addition to his power and money he had the virility of a Rasputin, one can probably believe him. And he was quite prepared to describe one episode after another. It was just that our ears were not prepared to listen to him. Even though no danger threatened him during those last years, he had frantically grabbed these women, messed them up, and then thrown them away like a greedy diner eating boiled crayfish, grabbing one, devouring it, sucking it, then grabbing the next. He was so accustomed to the malleability of material, to his own vigorous boar-like drive across the land. Whenever he was especially agitated, he would dash about the cell like a powerful boar who might just knock down an oak tree in his path. He was so accustomed to an environment in which all the leaders were his own kind of people, in which one could always make a deal, work things out, cover them up. He forgot that the more success one gains, the more envy one arouses. As he found out during his interrogation, a dossier had been accumulating against him since way back in 1936. On the basis of an anecdote he had carelessly told at a drunken party. More denunciations had followed, and more testimony from agents. After all, one has to take women to restaurants where all types of people see you. Another report pointed out that he had been in no hurry to leave Moscow in 1941, that he had been waiting for the Germans. He had, in actual fact, stayed on longer than he should have, apparently because of some woman. Z-blank-V took great care to keep his business deals clean, but he quite forgot the existence of Article 58. Nonetheless, the avalanche might not have overwhelmed him had he not grown overconfident and refused to supply building materials for a certain prosecutor's dasha. That was what caused his dormant case to awaken and tremble and start rolling. And this was one more instance of the fact that cases begin with the material self-interest of the Blue Boys. The scope of Z-blank-V's concepts of the world can be judged by the fact that he believed there was a Canadian language. During the course of 2 months in the cell, he did not read a single book, not even a whole page, and if he did read a paragraph, it was only to be distracted from his gloomy thoughts about his interrogation. It was clear from his conversation that he had read even less in freedom. He knew of Pushkin as the hero of Bawdy's stories. And of Tolstoy he knew only, in all probability, that he was a deputy of the Supreme Soviet. On the other hand, was he a 100% loyal communist? Was he that same socially conscious proletarian who had been brought up to replace Palchinsky and von Meck and their ilk? This was what was really surprising. He was most certainly not. We once discussed the whole course of the war with him. And I said that from the very first moment I had never had any doubts about our victory over the Germans. He looked at me sharply. He did not believe me. "Come on, what are you saying?" And then he took his head in his hands. "Oh, Sasha, Sasha, and I was convinced the Germans would win. That's what did me in." There you are. He was one of the organizers of victory, but each day he believed in the Germans' success and awaited their inevitable arrival. Not because he loved them, but simply because he had so sober an insight into our economy, which I, of course, knew nothing about and therefore believed in. All of us in the cell were deeply depressed, but none of us was so crushed as Z-blank-V. None took his arrest as so profound a tragedy. He learned from us that he would get no more than a tenner, that during his years in camp he would, of course, be a work superintendent, and that he would not have to experience real suffering, as indeed he never did. But this did not comfort him in the least. He was too stricken by the collapse of such a glorious life. After all, it was his one and only life on earth, and no one else's, which had interested him all his 36 years. And more than once, sitting on his cot in front of the table, propping his pudgy head on his short pudgy arm, he would start to sing quietly, in a sing-song voice, and with lost, befogged eyes. Forgotten and abandoned since my young, early years, I was left a tiny orphan. He could never get any further than that. At that point, he would break into explosive sobs. All that bursting strength which could not break through the walls that enclosed him, he turned inward toward self-pity, and toward pity for his wife. Every tenth day, since oftener was not allowed, his wife, long since unloved, brought him rich and bountiful food parcels, the whitest of white bread, butter, red caviar, veal, sturgeon. He would give her each of us a sandwich and a twist of tobacco, and then bend down to the provisions he had set before himself, delighting in odors and colors that contrasted vividly with the bluish potatoes of the old underground revolutionary Fastenko. Then his tears would start to pour again, redoubled. He recalled out loud his wife's tears, whole years of tears, some due to love notes she had found in his trousers, some to some woman's underpants in his overcoat pocket, stuffed there hurriedly in his automobile and forgotten. And when he was thus torn by burning self-pity, his armor of evil energy fell away, and before us was a ruined and clearly a good person. I was astonished that he could sob so. The Estonian Arnold Susi, our cellmate with the grey bristles in his hair, explained it to me. Cruelty is invariably accompanied by sentimentality. It is the law of complementaries. For example, in the case of the Germans, the combination is a national trait. Fastenko, on the other hand, was the most cheerful person in the cell, even though, in view of his age, he was the only one who could not count on surviving and returning to freedom. Flinging an arm around my shoulders, he would say, "To stand up for the truth is nothing. For truth you have to sit in jail." Or else he taught me to sing this song from Tsarist hard labor days. "And if we have to perish in mines and prisons wet, our cause will ever find renown in future generations yet." And I believe this. May these pages help his faith come true. The 16-hour days in our cell were short on outward events, but they were so interesting that I, for example, now find a mere 16 minutes' wait for a trolley bus much more boring. There were no events worthy of attention, and yet by evening I would sigh, because once more there had been not enough time. Once more the day had flown. The events were trivial, but for the first time in my life I learned to look at them through a magnifying glass. The most difficult hours in the day were the first two, at the rattle of the key in the lock, for at the Lubyanka there were no swill troughs, and it was necessary to unlock the door even to shout, "Time to get up." We jumped up without lingering, made our beds and sat down on them, feeling empty and helpless, with the electric light still burning. Special large openings in the cell doors of many Russian prisons, known to the prisoners as kormushki, meaning swill troughs or fodder bins. Their lids dropped down to make tiny tables. Conversations with the jailers were carried on through these openings, food was handed through, and prison papers were shoved through for the prisoners to sign. This enforced wakefulness from 6 a.m. on, at a time when the brain was still lazy from sleep, the whole world seemed repulsive and all of life wrecked, and there was not a gulp of air in the cell, was particularly ludicrous for those who had been under interrogation all night and had only just been able to get to sleep. But don't try to steal extra sleep. If you should try to doze off, leaning slightly against the wall or propped over the table as if studying the chessboard, or relaxing over a book lying conspicuously open on your knees, The key would sound a warning knock on the door, or worse yet, the door with that rattling lock would suddenly open silently, since the Lubyanka jailers were specially trained to do just that. And like a spirit passing through a wall, the swift and silent shadow of the junior sergeant would take 3 steps into the cell, hook on to you as you slept, and maybe take you off to the punishment cell. Or maybe they would take book privileges away from the whole cell or deprive everyone of their daily walk. A cruel, unjust punishment for all. And there were other punishments, too, in the black lines of the prison regulations. Read them. They hang in every cell. If, incidentally, you needed glasses to read, then you wouldn't be reading books or the sacred regulations either during those 2 starving hours. Eyeglasses were taken away every night, and it was evidently still dangerous for you to have them during those 2 hours when no one brought anything to the cell and no one came to it. No one asked about anything and no one was summoned. The interrogators were still sleeping sweetly. And the prison administration was just opening its eyes, coming to. Only the vertukhai, the turnkeys, were active and energetic, opening the peephole cover once a minute for inspection. During my time, this word vertukhai had already come into wide currency for the jailers. It was said to have originated with Ukrainian guards who were always ordering, "Stoi, tane vertukhais!" And yet it is also worth recalling the English word for jailer, turnkey, is vertiklyuch in Russian. Perhaps a vertukhai here in Russia is also one who turns the key. But one procedure was carried out during those 2 hours, the morning trip to the toilet. When the guard roused us, he made an important announcement. He designated the person from our cell who was to be entrusted with the responsibility of carrying out the latrine bucket. In more isolated, ordinary prisons, the prisoners had enough freedom of speech and self-government to decide this question themselves, but in the chief political prison, such an important event could not be left to chance. So then you formed up in single file, hands behind your backs, and at the head of the line, the responsible latrine bucket bearer carried, chest high, the 2-gallon tin pail with a lid on it. When you reached your goal, you were locked in again, each having first been handed a small piece of paper the size of 2 railway tickets. At the Lubyanka, this was not particularly interesting. The paper was blank and white. But there were enticing prisons where they gave you pages of books, and what reading that was. You could try to guess whence it came, read it over on both sides, digest the contents, evaluate the style. And when words had been cut in half, that was particularly essential. You could trade with your comrades. In some places they handed out pages from the once progressive Granat Encyclopedia, and sometimes, it's awful to say it, from the classics, and I don't mean belles lettres either. Visits to the toilet thus became a means of acquiring knowledge. But there's not that much to laugh at. We are dealing with that crude necessity which it is considered unsuitable to refer to in literature, although there too it has been said with immortal adroitness, "Blessed is he who early in the morning." This allegedly natural start of the prison day set a trap for the prisoner that would grip him all day, a trap for his spirit, which was what hurt. Given the lack of physical activity in prison, and the meager food, and the muscular relaxation of sleep, a person was just not able to square accounts with nature immediately after rising. Then they quickly returned you to the cell and locked you up, until 6 p.m., or in some prisons, until morning. At that point you would start to get worried and worked up by the approach of the daytime interrogation period and the events of the day itself, and you would be loading yourself up with your bread ration and water and gruel. But no one was going to let you visit that glorious accommodation again, easy access to which free people are incapable of appreciating. This debilitating, banal need could make itself felt day after day, shortly after the morning toilet trip, and would then torment you the whole day long, oppress you, rob you of the inclination to talk, read, think, and even of any desire to eat the meager food. People in the cells sometimes discussed how the Lubyanka system and schedule, and those in other prisons as well, had come into being, whether through calculated brutality or as a matter of chance. My opinion is that both factors are involved. The rising time is obviously a matter of malicious intent, but much of the rest evolved automatically at first, which is true of many of the brutalities of life generally. and was then discovered by the powers that be to be useful and was therefore made permanent. The shifts change at 8 a.m. and 8 p.m., and it was more convenient for everyone to take the prisoners to the toilet at the end of a shift. Letting them out singly in the middle of the day was extra trouble and meant extra precautions, and no one got paid for that. The same was true of the business with eyeglasses. Why should one worry about that at 6 a.m.? They could be returned to the owners just before the end of the shift instead. So now we heard them being brought around. Doors were being opened. We could guess whether someone wore them in the cell next door. And didn't your co-defendant wear spectacles? But we didn't feel up to knocking out a message on the wall. This was punished very severely. A moment later, they would bring the eyeglasses to our cell. Fastenko used them only for reading, but Susi needed them all the time. He could stop squinting once he'd put them on. Thanks to his horn-rimmed glasses and straight lines above the eyes, his face became severe, perspicacious, exactly the face of an educated man of our century, as we might picture it to ourselves. Back before the revolution, he had studied at the Faculty of History and Philology of the University of Petrograd, and throughout his 20 years in independent Estonia, he had preserved intact the purest Russian speech, which he spoke like a native. Later, in Tartu, he had studied law. In addition to Estonian, he spoke English and German, and through all these years he continued to read the London Economist and the German scientific Berichter summaries. He had studied the constitutions and the codes of law of various countries, and in our cell he represented Europe worthily and with restraint. He had been a leading lawyer in Estonia, and been known as Kultsu, meaning golden-tongued. There was new activity in the corridor. A freeloader in a grey smock, a husky young fellow who had certainly not been at the front, brought a tray with our 5 bread rations and 10 lumps of sugar. Our cell stoolie hovered over them, even though we would inevitably cast lots for them, which we did because every least detail of this was important. The heel of the loaf, for instance, and the number of smaller pieces needed to make the total weight come out right, and how the crust adheres, or doesn't, to the inside of the bread. And it was better that fate should decide. Where, indeed, in our country did this casting of lots not happen? It was the result of our universal and endless hunger. In the army, all rations were divided up the same way, and the Germans, who could hear what was going on from their trenches, teased us about it. Who gets it? The political commissar? But the stoolie felt he just had to hold everything in his hands for at least a second, so that some bread and sugar molecules would cling to his palms. That pound of unrisen wet bread, with its swamp-like sogginess of texture, made half with potato flour, was our crutch and the main event of the day. Life had begun. The day had begun. This was when it began. And everyone had countless problems. Had he allocated his bread ration wisely the day before? Should he cut it with a thread, or break it up greedily, or slowly, quietly nip off pieces one by one? Should he wait for tea, or pile into it right now? Should he leave some for dinner, or finish it off at lunch? And how much? In addition to these wretched dilemmas, what wide-ranging discussions and arguments went on, for our tongues had been liberated, and with bread we were once more men, provoked by this 1 pound chunk in our hand, consisting more of water than of grain. Incidentally, Fastenko explained that the workers of Moscow were eating the very same bread at that time. And generally speaking, was there any real bread grain in this bread at all? And what additives were in it? There was at least one person in every cell who knew all about additives, for after all, who hadn't eaten them during these past decades? Discussions and reminiscences began about the white bread they had baked back in the 20s, springy, round loaves like sponge cake inside, with a buttery, reddish-brown top crust and a bottom crust that still had a trace of ash from the coals of the hearth. That bread had vanished for good. Those born in 1930 would never know what bread is. Friends, this is a forbidden subject. We agreed not to say one word about food. Once again there was movement in the corridor. Tea was being brought around. a new young tough in a grey smock carrying pails. We put our teapot out in the corridor, and he poured straight into it from a pail without a spout, into the teapot and onto the runner and the floor beneath it, and the whole corridor was polished like that of a first-class hotel. Soon the biologist Timofeyev Resovsky, whom I have already mentioned, would be brought here from Berlin. There was nothing at the Lubyanka, it appeared, which so offended him as this spilling on the floor. He considered it striking evidence of the lack of professional pride on the part of the jailers, and of all of us in our chosen work. He multiplied the 27 years of Lubyanka's existence as a prison by 730 times, twice for each day of the year, and then by 111 cells, and he would seethe for a long time because it was easier to spill boiling water on the floor 2,188,000 times, and then come and wipe it up with a rag the same number of times, than to make pails with spouts. And that was all they gave us. Whatever cooked food we got would be served at 1 p.m. and at 4 p.m., one meal almost on the heels of the other. You could then spend the next 21 hours remembering it. And that wasn't prison brutality either. It was simply a matter of the kitchen staff having to do its work as quickly as possible and leave. At 9 o'clock, the morning check-up took place. For a long while beforehand, we could hear especially loud turns of the key and particularly sharp knocks on the doors. Then one of the duty lieutenants for the whole floor would march forward and enter, almost as erect as if he were standing at attention. He would take 2 steps forward and look sternly at us. We would be on our feet. We didn't even dare remember that political prisoners were once not required to rise. It was no work at all to count us. He could do it in a glance. But this was a moment for testing our rights. For we did have some rights, after all, although we did not really know them, and it was his job to hide them from us. The whole strength of the Lubyanka training showed itself in a totally machine-like manner. No expression on the face, no inflection, not a superfluous word. And which of our rights did we know about? A request to have our shoes repaired, an appointment with the doctor. Although if they actually took you to the doctor, you would not be happy about the consequences. There, the machine-like Lubyanka manner would be particularly striking. He didn't ask, "What's your trouble?" That would take too many words, and one couldn't pronounce the phrase without any inflection. He would ask curtly, "Troubles?" And if you began to talk at too great length about your ailment, he would cut you off. It was clear, anyway. A toothache? Extracted. You could have arsenic. A filling? We don't fill teeth here. That would have required additional appointments and created a somewhat humane atmosphere. The prison doctor was the interrogator's and executioner's right-hand man. The beaten prisoner would come to on the floor only to hear the doctor's voice. "You can continue. The pulse is normal." After a prisoner's 5 days and nights in a punishment cell, the doctor inspects the frozen, naked body and says, "You can continue." If a prisoner is beaten to death, he signs the death certificate, "Cirrhosis of the liver," or "Coronary occlusion." He gets an urgent call to a dying prisoner in a cell, and he takes his time, and whoever behaves differently is not kept on in the prison. Dr. F.P. Gartz would have earned nothing extra in our country. But our stoolie was better informed about his rights. According to him, he had already been under interrogation 11 months, and he was taken to interrogation only during the day. He spoke up and asked for an appointment with the prison chief. "What, the chief of the whole Lubyanka?" "Yes." His name was taken down. And in the evening, after taps, when the interrogators were already in their offices, he was summoned. And he returned with some makoka. This was very crude, of course, but so far they had not been able to think up anything better. It would have been a big expense to convert entirely to microphones in the walls, and impossible to listen in on all 111 cells for whole days at a time. Who would do it? Stool pigeons were cheaper, and would continue to be used for a long time to come. But Kramarenko had a hard time with us. Sometimes he eavesdropped so hard that the sweat poured from him, and we could see from his face that he didn't understand what we were saying. There was one additional right, the privilege of writing applications and petitions. which replaced freedom of the press, of assembly, and of the ballot, all of which we'd lost when we left freedom. Twice a month, the morning duty officer asked, "Who wants to write a petition?" And they listed everyone who wanted to. In the middle of the day, they would lead you to an individual box and lock you up in it. In there, you could write whomever you pleased, the father of the peoples, the central committee of the party, the Supreme Soviet, Minister Beria, Minister Abakumov, the general prosecutor, the chief military prosecutor, the prison administration, the investigation department. You could complain about your arrest, your interrogator, even the chief of the prison. In each and every case, your petition would have no effect whatever. It would not be stapled into any file, and the most senior official to read it would be your own interrogator. However, you were in no position to prove this. In fact, it was rather more likely that he would not read it, because no one would be able to read it on a piece of paper measuring 7 by 10 centimeters, in other words, 3 by 4 inches, a little larger than the paper given you each morning at the toilet, with a pen broken in the middle or bent into a hook, and an inkwell with pieces of rag in it and ink diluted with water. You would just be able to scratch out Petit, then the letters would all run together on the cheap paper. Eon couldn't be worked into the line, and everything would come through on the other side of the sheet. You might have still other rights, but the duty officer would keep quiet about them. And you wouldn't be losing much, truth to tell, even if you didn't find out about them. The check-up came and went, and the day began. The interrogators were already arriving there somewhere. The turnkey would summon one of us with a great air of secrecy. He called out the first letter of the name only, like this. "Whose name begins with S?" And, "Whose name begins with F?" Or perhaps, "Whose begins with M?" "With Am?" And you yourself had to be quick-witted enough to recognize that it was you he wanted, and offer yourself as a victim. This system was introduced to prevent mistakes on the jailer's part. He might have called out a name in the wrong cell, and that way we might have found out who else was in prison. And yet, though cut off from the entire prison, we were not deprived of news from other cells. Because they tried to crowd in as many prisoners as possible, they shuffled them about from cell to cell, and every newcomer brought all his accumulated experience to his new cell. Thus it was that we, imprisoned on the fourth floor, knew all about the cellar cells, about the boxes on the first floor, about the darkness on the second floor, where the women were all kept, about the split-level arrangement of the fifth, and about the biggest cell of all on the fifth floor, number 111. Before my time, the children's writer, Bondarin, had been a prisoner in our cell, and before that he had been on the women's floor with some Polish correspondent or other, who had previously been a cellmate of Field Marshal von Paulus, and that was how we learned all the details about von Paulus. The period for being summoned to interrogation passed, and for those left in the cell, a long, pleasant day stretched ahead, lightened by opportunities, and not overly darkened by duties. Duties could include sterilizing the cots with a blowtorch twice a month. At the Lubyanka, matches were categorically forbidden to prisoners. To get a light for a cigarette, we had to signal patiently with a finger when the peephole was opened, thus asking the jailer for a light. But blowtorches were entrusted to us without hesitation. And once a week we might be called into the corridor to have our faces clipped with a dull clipper, allegedly a right but strongly resembling a duty. And one might be signed the duty of cleaning the parquet floor in the cell. Z-blank-V always avoided this work because it was beneath his dignity, like any other work, in fact. We got out of breath quickly because we were underfed. Otherwise, we would have considered this duty a privilege. It was such gay, lively work, pushing the brush forward with one's bare foot, torso pulled back, and then turn about. Forward, back, and forget all your grief. Shiny as a mirror, a Potemkin prison. Besides, we didn't have to go on being overcrowded in our old cell 67 any longer. In the middle of March, they added a sixth prisoner to our number, and since here in the Lubyanka they did not fill all the cells with board bunks, nor make you sleep on the floor, they transferred all of us into a beauty of a cell, number 53. I would advise anyone who has not yet been in it to pay it a visit. This was not a cell. It was a palace chamber set aside as a sleeping apartment for distinguished travelers. The Rossiya Insurance Company, without a thought for economy, had raised the height of the ceiling in this wing to 16.5 feet. This company acquired a piece of Moscow earth that was well acquainted with blood. The innocent Vereshchagin was torn to pieces in 1812 on Filkosovsky, near the Rostopchin house. And the murderess and serf owner Saltychika lived and killed serfs on the other side of the Bolshaya Lubyanka. In Moscow, edited by N.A. Gainika and others, Moscow, Sabashnikov Publishers, 1917, page 231. Oh, what four-story bunks the chief of counterintelligence at the front would have slapped in here, and he could have gotten 100 people in, results guaranteed. And the window. It was such an enormous window that, standing on its sill, the jailer could hardly reach the fototchka, that hinged ventilation pane. One section of this window alone would have made a fine whole window in an ordinary house. Only the riveted steel sheets of the muzzle, closing off 4/5 of it, reminded us that we were not in a palace after all. Nonetheless, on clear days, above this muzzle, from the wall of the Lubyanka courtyard, from some window pane or other on the 6th or 7th floor, we now and then got a pale reflection of a ray of sunlight. To us it was a real ray of sunlight, a living, dear being. We followed with affection its climb up the wall, and every step it made was filled with meaning, presaging the time of our daily outing in the fresh air, counting off several half hours before lunch. Then, just before lunch, it disappeared. And our rights included being let out for a walk, reading books, telling one another about the past, listening and learning, arguing and being educated. And we would be rewarded by a lunch that included 2 courses. Too good to be true. The walk was bad on the first 3 floors of the Lubyanka. The prisoners were let out into a damp, low-lying little courtyard, the bottom of a narrow well between the prison buildings. But the prisoners on the 4th and 5th floors, on the other hand, were taken to an eagle's perch on the roof of the 5th floor. It had a concrete floor. There were concrete walls 3 times the height of a man. We were accompanied by an unarmed jailer. On the watchtower was a sentinel with an automatic weapon. But the air was real, and the sky was real. Hands behind your back. Line up in pairs. No talking. No stopping. Such were the commands, but they forgot to forbid us to throw back our heads. And, of course, we did just that. Here one could see not a reflected, not a second-hand sun, but the real one, the real, eternally living sun itself, or its golden diffusion through the spring clouds. Spring promises everyone happiness, and tenfold to the prisoner. Oh, April sky! It didn't matter that I was in prison. Evidently they were not going to shoot me, and in the end I would become wiser here. I would come to understand many things here, heaven. I would correct my mistakes yet, O heaven, not for them, but for you, heaven. I had come to understand those mistakes here, and I would correct them. As if from a pit, from the far-off lower reaches, from Dzerzhinsky Square, the hoarse, earthly singing of the automobile horns rose to us in a constant refrain. To those who were dashing along to the tune of those honkings, they seemed the trumpets of creation, but from here their insignificance was very clear. The walk in the fresh air lasted only 20 minutes, but how much there was about it to concern oneself with, how much one had to accomplish while it lasted. In the first place, it was very interesting to try to figure out the layout of the entire prison while they were taking you there and back, and to calculate where those tiny hanging courtyards were, so that at some later date, out in freedom, one could walk along the square and spot their location. We made many turns on the way there, and I invented the following system. Starting from the cell itself, I would count every turn to the right as +1, and every turn to the left as -1. And no matter how quickly they made us turn, the idea was not to try to picture it hastily to oneself, but to count up the total. If, in addition, through some staircase window, you could catch a glimpse of the backs of the Lubyanka water nymphs, half reclining against the pillared turret which hovered over the square itself, and you could remember the exact point in your count when this happened, then back in the cell you could orient yourself and figure out what your own window looked out on. And during that outdoor walk, you concentrated on breathing as much fresh air as possible. There, too, alone beneath that bright heaven, you had to imagine your bright future life, sinless and without error. There, too, was the best place of all to talk about the most dangerous subjects. It didn't matter that conversation during the walk was forbidden. One simply had to know how to manage it. The compensation was that in all likelihood you could not be overheard, either by a stoolie or by a microphone. During these walks, I tried to get into a pair with Susie. We talked together in the cell, but we liked to try talking about the main things here. We hadn't come together quickly, it took some time, but he had already managed to tell me a great deal. I acquired a new capability from him, to accept patiently and purposefully things that had never had any place in my own plans, and had, it seemed, no connection at all with the clearly outlined direction of my life. From childhood on, I had somehow known that my objective was the history of the Russian Revolution, and that nothing else concerned me. To understand the Revolution, I had long since required nothing beyond Marxism. I cut myself off from everything else that came up, and turned my back on it. And now, fate brought me together with Susie. He breathed a completely different sort of air, and he would tell me passionately about his own interests, and these were Estonia and democracy. And although I had never expected to become interested in Estonia, much less bourgeois democracy, I nevertheless kept listening and listening to his loving stories of 23 years in that modest, work-loving, small nation of big men whose ways were slow and set. I listened to the principles of the Estonian constitution, which had been borrowed from the best of European experience, and to how their 100-member, one-house parliament had worked. And though the why of it wasn't clear, I began to like it all and store it all away in my experience. Susie remembered me later as a strange mixture of Marxist and Democrat. Yes, things were wildly mixed up inside me at that time. I listened willingly to their fatal history. The tiny Estonian anvil had, from way, way back, been caught between two hammers, the Teutons and the Slavs. Blows showered on it from east and west in turn. There was no end to it, and there still isn't. And there was the well-known, totally unknown, story of how we Russians wanted to take them over in one fell swoop in 1918, but they refused to yield. And how, later on, Yudenich spoke contemptuously of their Finnish heritage, and we ourselves christened them White Guard Bandits. Then the Estonian gymnasium students enrolled as volunteers. We struck at Estonia again in 1940, and again in 1941, and again in 1944. Some of their sons were conscripted by the Russian army, and others by the German army, and still others ran off into the woods. The elderly Tallinn intellectuals discussed how they might break out of that iron ring, break away somehow, and live for themselves and by themselves. Their premier might possibly have been TF, and their minister of education, say, Susie. But neither Churchill nor Roosevelt cared about them in the least. But Uncle Joe did. And during the very first nights after the Soviet armies entered Tallinn, all these dreamers were seized in their Tallinn apartments. 15 of them were imprisoned in various cells of the Moscow Lubyanka, one in each, and were charged under Article 58(2) with the criminal desire for national self-determination. Each time we returned to the cell from our walk was like being arrested again. Even in our very special cell, the air seemed stifling after the outdoors, and it would have been good to have a snack afterward, too. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.